Good evening. A2RIW here. At this time, Mel and Dick in the TechNet. And for those who haven't heard the TechNet before, it's a method by which people come together and help each other get a little more enjoyment out of this hobby of ham radio. Teach each other how to get more performance out of our equipment, how things work, what are the rules and regulations, what are people doing that's fun, things like that. Antennas, transmission lines, transmitters, receivers, propagation, 26 or so different kinds of ham radio get discussed, and a few other things. Any subject that is of interest to radio amateurs is appropriate for this technical net. Amateurs are curious people. They get involved in quite a few things that are involved with the art and science of radio, computers, radio propagation. A person signs into the TechNet by giving Mel and Dick your call letters, your name. You have to give us your name because I'm kind of forgetful. And you follow that with a yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. Do we have any check-ins at this time? Please give me your call letters and name.
2RSO, Frank, yes.
Frank recognized. Anyone else?
Dick, WHCDL just put the message for you.
Okay, Andy. Anyone else?
KB1NNH, no.
Is that November? November Hotel?
Yes. And it's a no on the question.
Okay. Anyone else check in?
Good evening, all. This is K2KEY.
Mel recognized. Anyone else?
And this is WS2N. Paul with an L. Good evening.
Very good, Paul. I bet you'll have some information for us about space. And by the time Frank finishes with his question, maybe you're going to have a question. Anyone else? Okay, let's start off with Frank. N2RSO, I think it is. And it looks like we don't have very many people checking in right now, so you can take your own sweet time and ask us two or three questions if you want, Frank. You've got the floor.
Okay, thank you, Dick. I was waiting to hear the tone, the beep, but I guess it's not doing it. Good evening, this is Frank, N2RSO, and my question has to do with a simple little piece of electronic equipment known as the NE2, I believe it is, neon bulb or neon lamp. And basically, I'm curious to know why my plug-in emergency lamp, which I have in the kitchen, when it was brand new, it would function in the following manner. A neon light would be on just to show that it was working, and if there were a power failure, a light would go on to light the kitchen and allow me to continue chopping my celery without cutting off my fingers. As the unit got older, and I noticed this with other pieces of electronic apparatus, the neon bulb begins to flicker. And the flickering is dependent upon the amount of ambient light in the room. Sometimes it's a solid glow, sometimes it's off, and sometimes it just blinks on and off. My question is, why?
Yeah, that's a goodie, Frank. My first guess, Mel's going to correct me on this one, is that it's a kind of a photoelectric effect. I'll first tell you how a gas becomes ionized and how it starts emitting light. I found this out because I've been studying high voltage circuits lately, and I wondered why air will sustain 30,000 volts per centimeter. If I've got two probes that are nice and rounded, 1 centimeter apart, and I slowly raise the voltage on those, at around 30,000 volts, you'll suddenly get an arc between the two, right through the air. It'll look like a spark coming out of a spark plug. Neon, under certain pressures, inside of the bulb of your NE2 bulb, light bulb, probably ionizes more like 55 or 60 volts. I know because in my youth, I built a relaxation oscillator with a 67-volt radio battery, which was popular way back in the late 40s, early 50s. a 67-volt battery. I think it was a half megohm resistor. I don't know what the value of the capacitor was. Maybe it was 0.05 or something like that. And a neon bulb. And the thing would flash on and off about once every second. And I remember running this thing for a couple of days. Had it in my room. My family would turn out the lights, and I could watch this neon bulb flashing at me all night long. And it gave me some pleasure that I had built this circuit that would do this. And I noticed that when the light was on, the flashing occurred at a different rate than when the light was off. The light went on. When the light was on, it would flash at a faster rate. What was really happening is the neon bulb would ionize at a lower voltage. It would, by the way, the way that relaxation oscillator worked is that the half microfarad, the half megohm resistor charged up the capacitor. The neon bulb was across the capacitor. When the voltage hit the critical voltage, which I'm going to make a number, I guess, let's say 62 volts. At 62 volts, the neon bulb would ignite. It starts drawing current. It pulls the voltage on the capacitor down to something like 55 volts or so, and the light goes out, and the process repeats. And with the light on, the light bulb
repeater, timeout, cancel.
When the room light is on, the neon bulb, instead of ionizing at 62 volts, would ionize at 60 volts or something like that. So it's a photoelectric effect. In other words, light photons getting into the bulb of a neon light would allow it to ignite at a lower voltage. There are transistors that'll do that. There are gases that'll do that. There are quite a few things that experience the photoelectric effect. That's what I think is going on here. Neon bulbs do eventually sort of wear out. By that I mean the neon side changes its pressure value. Even though you think the glass bulb is a perfect seal, a little bit of the neon slowly leaks out, and maybe a little bit of the air molecule slowly leak in. I know that whenever you have a helium neon laser, the helium neon laser, even though it's a glass envelope, rarely operates beyond 7 years, because within the first 7 years, enough of the helium leaks out of the glass that it doesn't have the right ratio anymore, and the neon, the helium neon laser will no longer strike. It'll no longer ignite, no longer do its thing. So you get a combination of contaminants slowly leaking in and neon slowly leaking out, and therefore it changes its characteristics. As it changes its characteristics, it starts becoming more persnickety, and it needs a little extra help, either higher voltage, higher current, or greater ionization phenomena going on. A cosmic ray coming along can help it light up, or a photon coming along because you turned on light in the room. That's my best guess. Now, I bet you Mel has experimented with neon bulbs over the years, and I bet you he's come to some conclusions. Mel, tell us what relaxation oscillators and things like that you've built. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Yeah, with the... Yeah, this is K2KEY. You said one of my first cold practice oscillators after I graduated from the buzzer was a relaxation oscillator made with an NE2. And the battery was a 90-volt B battery, if you'll remember, Dick. It's now 67.5 with 90-volt B battery. And what used to happen in an NE2's little pigtail neon lamp, if you'll notice, after a number of years, it gets a dark spot on it. One side of it gets dark. It gets a sort of a blackish looking like a tinge on it, on the side of the lamp. And then it starts to become somewhat critical. In fact, some of them stop working, you know. But they, at that point, when they get to that critical point, like you say, you shine a light on them, and this funny thing, I remember that, it could even make the sometimes a little neon that which now bobs down. You know, it doesn't light fully, bobs sort of up and down. With I used to, with a bright light, I was able to actually make it bob up and down, Dick, over.
In other words, the portion that was ionized would either be at the top of those two little prongs inside, or at the bottom, or in the middle. It actually moved. And I think they sell a kind of Christmas tree light, which has an internal arcing like that, that looks like a flame because it jumps up and down. I think I've seen those at Harrow's and places like that in the past. They sell Christmas tree lights. Now, what really goes on and I know this is a little bit off subject, but some people sort of enjoy the extra information. How does air ionize? How does air arc over? How does your spark plug work? And why does air behave differently at different pressures? And I've been studying that a little bit, reading some literature, and I'll find out that at 30,000 volts per inch, per centimeter, 78,000 volts per inch, at that amount of local E-field, in other words, you've got that amount of voltage across that much of a gap between two metal plates, if a cosmic ray comes along, strikes an air molecule, and separates its electron from its nucleus, one of its electrons from the nucleus of the oxygen, the nitrogen, whatever, you've got one free electron floating around, and he sees a positive plate nearby, and a negative plate in the other direction, he gets compelled by the negative plate, the electron is negative, he gets highly attracted to the positive plate, and he takes off like a bat out of hell. He starts moving real fast. And he's only going to move a certain distance before he strikes the next air molecule. And if the voltage is high enough, and if the spacing between the air molecules is great enough, he gets the opportunity to get up to a high enough velocity. Now, when he strikes the next air molecule, he ionizes it. He separates the next electron from its nucleus, and he starts an avalanche effect. And once that avalanche effect gets going, you and I call it an arc. Okay. Now, if I suddenly put twice as much air pressure between those two electrodes that have the exact same voltage, you don't get an arc anymore. And the reason for that is the higher pressure means the air molecules are packed in tighter, they're closer together. On average, when a free electron does get created, he doesn't get a chance to get up enough velocity before he strikes the next air molecule. And if he ain't moving fast enough, he doesn't...
Repeater, time out, cancel.
If he's not moving fast enough, he doesn't ionize the next air molecule, and the process stops. Conversely, when you take your high voltage power supply and you put it in your airplane, and you put it in a portion of the airplane which is not in the pressurized cabin, and you fly to a higher altitude, unless you've done a good design job, you'll suddenly realize that your power supply that worked perfectly good at sea level, at 30,000 feet, it'll arc over. At around 30 or 35,000 feet, there's something you can look up called the Paschen Law, P-A-S-C-H-E-N. This guy Paschen did a whole lot of experiments. He found out at lower air pressure, air will ionize at a lower voltage. And the reason for that is the lower air pressure means the air molecules are further apart. The electron gets a chance to move a longer distance in the accelerating field. He gets a chance to build up a big enough velocity, and therefore he'll arc over the next air molecule. He'll ionize the next one, begin the avalanche process. So this is some of what's going on inside of your neon bulb. There's a lot of physics happening there, Frank, and your observation of the light being on and the neon bulb acting differently is a good observation. N2RSO, with his science question. K2RIW on the deck, man.
Okay, Dick. Thank you. Yeah. I guess it's analogous to a balloon, helium-filled balloon. I think you had mentioned this last week or the week before, how it loses its helium, which is replaced by the outside air, and eventually that balloon that was stuck to the ceiling falls to the ground, the floor. So I guess it's a similar effect with the neon lamp. So, okay, thanks again, and back to that, N2RSO.
Yeah, let me give you a few more words on that helium-filled balloon. Helium is the smallest molecule that I know of. I think it's around 0.7 or something like that. 0.9 angstroms is the radius of a helium molecule, the average radius. Those helium molecules can walk through the pores in the rubber of the balloon. Heavy helium walks out of the balloon. Not very much air goes back in. I think almost none. But here's a science question for you. Assume I've got two identical balloons. And by the way, the knowledge I'm about to give you is very important when it comes to medicine. And you'll soon see the relationship. A physician should know this, what I'm about to tell you. I got two identical balloons. And they're, one of them is fully inflated with air, and the other one is only half inflated. Both of them are connected to
a metal pipe, and there's a rubber band wrapped around the balloon holding it to the pipe. So on the left-hand side of the pipe, with the rubber band wrapped around it, is the fully inflated balloon. On the right-hand side of the pipe is the half-inflated balloon connected to the same pipe, the right-hand side. And there's a valve in between that has been closed at the time that I'm doing this connection. At T equals zero, I open the valve. So the fully inflated balloon is on the left, the half-inflated balloon is on the right, and I've just opened the valve. What's your guess, Frank, as to what's going to happen, K2RIW?
My guess is that the pressure will be equalized. It will be the same in each balloon.
If that was the answer, do you think I'd be asking this question, Frank?
Definitely not. I knew there was a lot more to it.
What else? Mother Nature is a blank, starts with a B. This world, she did not make it interesting, easy for us to understand. You do that experiment, and lots of people have. The half-inflated balloon will deflate, the fully inflated balloon will inflate more. The small one gets smaller, the big one gets bigger. And you're about to ask why. Before I answer that, let me give you two other pieces of information that will tap into your experience with balloons. When you first start blowing up a balloon for your child's birthday party, you realize in the beginning, pushing air from your lungs in that balloon is very difficult. And you say to yourself, well, I didn't stretch the rubber enough. And yet, at the end of the inflation process, it's very easy. Clue number one. Clue number two, you take a fully inflated balloon and you let go of it, and it goes squirting around the room. And if you listen carefully, you'll notice that at the end of its deflation, as it's running around the room, it moves a lot faster. The air runs out faster, and it moves faster. Clue number two. Clue number three. Assume I'm a 200-pound person. And if I ride a full-size, fat-wheeled American bicycle, I inflate those tires to 28 pounds. Any more than that, I might burst the tire. Any less than that, the tire will feel kind of soft. 28 pounds is fine for an American fat-wheeled bicycle. Yet my same 200 pounds on a British bicycle, the ones with the skinny tires, need 70 pounds of air. If I only inflated them with 28 pounds, I'd be down to the rim. The rim would be rubbing on the road. Clue number three. I take the 3,000-pound automobile that I own, and each of those tires, which are great big fat tires by comparison to a bicycle, almost 1,000 pounds of weight is at each wheel, and yet I only inflate those tires to 28 pounds. And they're holding up 1,000 pounds each wheel. The bottom line is that there's an extremely interesting relationship between the radius of an inflated device, the curvature of its surface, in other words, versus the air pressure on the inside caused by the stretch of the rubber in all of those cases. And the reason why this is so important to... The reason why this is so important to a person in medicine is a very dangerous condition you can have with a blood vessel called an aneurysm. That's where the blood vessel balloons out in one direction. And as that blood vessel, due to some kind of a failure, balloons out, if you don't catch it pretty fast, it becomes a runaway condition, because as the blood vessel balloons more and more, the exact same amount of blood pressure on the inside exerts a greater and greater pressure on the surface of the vessel itself as it goes larger in diameter. Very similar to what happens with a very small diameter object, the 70 pounds that you put into the British bicycle, the English racer bicycle. It's got a small radius, takes a lot of pounds of pressure to fully inflate it. The American fat wheel bike, bigger diameter, doesn't take as much pressure. The automobile tire, much bigger in diameter, only 28 pounds is required to hold up a 1,000-pound automobile for that particular corner of the automobile, the wheel. I'm assuming there's I'm rounding off the numbers and assuming there's 1,000 pounds of weight on each one of the four wheels. And the explanation for why that happens is sort of interesting. Maybe I've gone too far with this one, but maybe you guys have got some guesses. You've gotten a whole lot of clues, and maybe you've got a guess as to what's happening. Anyone want to give us a guess? Give me a call letters right now. K2RIW on the TechNet. And while we're waiting for that, I know Andy had a piece of information he wanted to give us. Andy, why don't you take this opportunity right now and give me or us your piece of information. But A2CDL, K2RIW.
I hear that noise attack. No, I just want to let you know, you're not linked to the Eastern repeater, if you didn't know that. You're not linked because of the internet connection is still down, just to let you know. Thanks. I gotta go because I'm in the middle of something, but I'm listening.
Very fine, Andy. If I contacted the technical committee of LIMARC, what would their prediction be as to when the link might be back up?
It was supposed to be back last week, but apparently there's a problem at the site. I understand, and they're working on it, so hopefully this week is my guess.
Okay, Andy. It's good to know. So, when it comes to the curvature of an inflated surface, whether it be a tire, a child's balloon, an aneurysm, or a helium-filled balloon, anybody have a guess as to why the size of the object and the pressure have this crazy relationship? Anyone want to make a guess?
Yeah, does it have anything to do, Dick, with displacement?
Not quite sure what you mean by displacement, so give me a few more words.
Boy, it's quite noisy here. What do I mean by displacement? I guess it's similar to, how high a piece of metal will, float on water by its, I don't know how to explain it, but, when you set something on water, the amount of depth that it'll sink down has to do with the amount of displacement of the area of the piece of equipment. I guess I'm not phrasing it right, Dick, over.
Okay, you could be saying one of two different things there, Mel. One would be the skin effect. There are bugs that can walk on the surface of water by what's called the skin effect. You could take a razor blade very carefully, place it on a cup of water, and it will float. Push the razor blade below the water so it no longer is experiencing the skin effect, and it'll sink to the bottom. So there's a number of things that will float due to skin effect of water. The outer surface of the water behaves in a peculiar way. And, that's not it in this case. I'll try to explain it, and it's not an easy one. Take a small radius device, like the British racing bike tire, and look at it in cross-section. And let's assume now that I'm going to study the upper arc between the 10 o'clock, the 12 o'clock, and the 2 o'clock position. That arc of the rubber, I'm going to study it. And if I recognize the fact that the rubber is being stretched by the air pressure on the inside, and the stretch of the rubber is linear to the surface, could say that at the 10 o'clock position, the stretch of the rubber is pulling in the linear direction, which means that it's applying a force to the lower left and to the upper right from the 10 o'clock position on this round cross-section of rubber that I'm looking at for the tire. So, left-hand side, I've got a force. The force that I feel like studying right now is the one that's going down to the lower left. And simultaneously, I'll study the 2 o'clock position on the rubber tire. And because of the stretch of the rubber in that direction, I'm going to look at the force vector that's pulling down to the lower right, parallel to the rubber at the 2 o'clock position. So if I combine those two vectors, the one at the 2 o'clock position pulling to the lower right, and the 10 o'clock position pulling to the lower left, that's the arrow direction of the force vector due to tension on the rubber, and I combine the two, the combined lower left force and upper right, lower left and the 10 o'clock force and the 2 o'clock force, if I combine them, it'll be one composite vector at the 12 o'clock position aiming straight down. That's the way those two force vectors will...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
So there'll be one force vector left, as I said, at the 12 o'clock position aiming straight down. The force to the decomposition of that 10 o'clock force had a horizontal and a vertical component. So did the one at the 2 o'clock position. The two horizontal components canceled. They're in opposite directions. But the vertical component of the 10 o'clock force and the vertical component of the 2 o'clock force are both downward. They add. So the net result is a larger vector, roughly at 12 o'clock, aim straight down. That vector is the one that's compensating for the air pressure on the inside of the tire pushing outward. The force of the tension on this vector I just helped you guys calculate is fighting the air pressure. It's pushing inward when the air pressure is pushing outward. And you'll notice that you get a reasonably large force at the 12 o'clock position pushing down. If now I flip over from the small diameter English racer bicycle tire, and I flip over to the automobile tire, which is 10 or 20 times larger in diameter of its cross-section. I'm looking at the cross-section of the tire as if I had sliced straight through it. I've made a thin slice of the tire. I've laid it on the desk, and I'm looking at it. Obviously, the automobile tire has a much larger radius to its chunk of rubber. It still has a 2 o'clock position and a 10 o'clock position, but they are much further apart. If I only looked 1 inch to the left of the 12 o'clock position and 1 inch to the right of the 12 o'clock position, let's call it the 11:30 and the 1:30, because there is a much larger radius of curvature on the automobile tire compared to the English racing bicycle tire, the force of a stretch of the rubber might be the same. Might be the exact same force of stretch. Let's put a number on it. 100 pounds of stretch on the rubber for either the automobile tire or the bicycle tire. But because the automobile tire has a much larger radius, much flatter curve, the force vector at the 11:30 position, 1 inch to the left in both cases for automobile tire.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Automobile tire and bicycle tire. I'm in each case going 1 inch to the left and to the right of the 12 o'clock position. But because there's much less curvature on the automobile tire, the exact same 100 pounds of force due to stretch, that vector, is much more parallel to the ground in my example. So therefore, although the left-hand force is 100 pounds and the right-hand force is 100 pounds, and the horizontal portion cancels, the vertical portion is now a much smaller vector. I'm adding two vectors together that are almost parallel and opposite to each other. At the 12 o'clock position, the resultant vector is much smaller. The bottom line of all this is that a larger radius diameter inflated object takes very little air pressure to create a whole lot of stretch vector on the rubber because the rubber can't fight back. The stretch of the rubber gives you a vector that's pushing inward to fight the air pressure, but it's a much smaller vector pushing inward when the rubber is much closer to a large radius, much closer to a flat surface. It's not an easy explanation to understand. I understand, Alan. It's a tough concept to get, but it isn't because you didn't stretch the rubber enough when you first start inflating that birthday balloon. Let me drop. It isn't because you weren't inflating it enough, stretching the rubber enough. That balloon is very hard to inflate in the beginning simply because it has a small diameter. It's got a very large radius of curvature. The other way around. Small radius of curvature. And as such, it can fight your air pressure much more easily. And the rubber is actually being stretched more at the end. The actual tension on the rubber at the end of the inflation is greater. And yet the amount of lung pressure required for you to inflate the balloon at the end is a hell of a lot less because the balloon is getting larger. And this explains why an aneurysm that ever happens in your blood system is so darn dangerous, and why it's got to be caught early before it becomes a runaway condition. Anybody have any further questions or comments on this little bit of a deviation that we took here in science, give me a call at us right now, K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2KEY.
Mel recognized. Anyone else?
KB2VDV. Did Richie check in this evening and to EO?
No, he did not. KB2 Victor Delta Delta, is that?
Yeah, Richard seems to be MIA.
Okay. I think this is Laura, is that true?
Yeah, so I'm worried. I thought something's wrong because he never misses your show here.
He has missed Oh, one show in six or so. Once in a while he does this. He falls asleep, or Jingle keeps him busy, or his father keeps him busy. So, I guess you could place a phone call there. Okay, yeah, Mel, K2KEY, go right ahead.
Yes, Roger. This is K2KEY. Yeah, I noticed one thing. You know, you bring up a very good point and a very good demonstration of it. They have these rafts that they sell for the pool. For kids, it's about maybe 4 feet long by about 3 foot wide. And when it's blown up, it's about 4 inches thick. And I noticed that the valve on it, you can blow it up very easy. You know, it's easier to blow that up with your mouth than a balloon stick. And in fact, when you blow it up, you think you'd have to close it real quick, you know, the valve point. But it shows you the air don't really run out of it so fast, Dick. Over.
Again, a larger radius of diameter, larger radius of curvature. Less air pressure is required to get the same amount of surface tension, the stretch of the rubber, so to speak, or the vinyl that's made out of your pool raft. Yeah, air pressure is interesting stuff. A very small amount of it over a large area can do some tremendous things. I mean, if somebody gave you enough buckets of ping pong balls, and you keep swimming down to the Queen Mary that's sunk in the water, we'll say, assume it's a very large ship sunk, and the portion of the hull is fully enclosed, and you start piling ping pong balls in there, in theory, eventually you'll float the whole darn vessel to the surface. You could have an inflatable bag that you put inside of the ship you want to raise. And with a simple pump up above, you slowly keep pumping air into it, and eventually you'll raise it to the surface. I know they use expandable air bags to lift portions of the concrete that were crushing down on automobiles during that earthquake they had out in California, where parts of the Oakland Freeway had crushed down onto automobiles. And by putting inflatable bags around the automobiles, they were able to raise these very heavy chunks of concrete and in some cases extricate people that were stuck inside of these crushed automobiles. So hydraulics is an interesting science. Good to know more about it. There are times when information will be handy and even a life-saving information once you've got it. Let's see if we got any further questions on any subject. Anyone else want to sign into the TechNet? Give me a call, letters, and name at this time, and the yes or no if you do have a question or a comment. K2RIW listening.
N2RSO.
Go right ahead, Frank.
Just to reinforce your last statement, or statements, just take a look at pneumatic hammers for breaking concrete and the air brakes on trucks. Powerful force.
Yeah, in that case of an air jackhammer, there's a lot of impulse energy taking place there. In other words, the pneumatic air pressure moves a piston, which moves a weight. The weight, like a hammer, comes slamming against another chunk of metal that is the chisel. And so, when you and I swing a hammer against the chisel, the actual force your arm is applying to the hammer maybe is 10 pounds, and you're accelerating that hammer through, let's say, a 1 or 2 foot distance with the 10-pound force your arm is creating on the handle of the hammer, and when the head of the hammer strikes the top of your cold chisel, at that instant of impact, where you've got a moving object, a stationary object, both of them are a rigid piece of metal. It looks like it's going to have a little bit of an interference here tonight. We may have to kill that person that drives out of the way before we continue. Let's see. As he gets closer to the repeater, he'll eventually overtake my signal, but he's got to be within a 1 mile radius to do that, so we know exactly where he is when he's doing it. And if he's driving in that direction and gets stronger, we'll not only know where he is, but how long he's going to be there and whether or not I'll be able to overpower him. So, at the instant that hammer strikes the top of your chisel, a few thousand pounds of force are taking place at that impulse. and the end of the chisel, the cold, the sharp end of it, is also exerting a few thousand pounds of force on the chunk of concrete you're breaking. So a jackhammer is using that phenomenon, the impulse of two metallic objects striking each other, and the energy you've put into the hammer, you've done it over an arc of a couple of a foot or two. You had a length of time to build up the velocity of the hammer, very similar to that electron I was using in the earlier example with a high voltage. Does the electron have enough distance to accelerate through before he strikes the next air molecule? And so all of the energy that you impart in that hammer when you move it a foot or two with the 10 pounds of force of your hand accelerating it, all gets dissipated when the hammer strikes the chisel, and the chisel only has to move a 16th of an inch or a 32nd of an inch. You've got the same amount of energy dissipated from a 2-foot swing dissipated in a 32nd of an inch. You get a huge force multiplication when you do that. A jackhammer uses that phenomenon.
Okay, after the VHB filtering, your 10.76 becomes 5.38. Don't forget that each symbol is 3 bits. So when you finally whack it all together, the throughput in bits is 19.39 megabits.
Okay, 3 bits per sample. That tells you the 8 levels and 5.38 mega samples per second. And that pilot tone is what helps you find out exactly when the sampling should take place, because that is your frequency reference for doing the sampling function. Is that approximately true? Go ahead.
That's absolutely spot on. That's why it's absolutely important for that training signal to exist first. And it starts with that, and it continues with, well, actually, if I go down here, I can tell you exactly the next level of synchronization. But the pilot is what's used to start things with, and that's why they really want precise frequency standards going into it. But what they do, where is it? I got it here somewhere. We start layers. After that, data synchronization comes at the next level, because there's data synchronization at the MPEG-2 level, which is built into MPEG, which is an elementary stream. What we're really talking about is the transport stream. The transport stream is built at 188 bytes per packet, and the first three bytes have a specific, I think one is a 47 hex, and another one is a something else, and another one is a something else. And from that, that derives the clock, which runs the Reed-Solomon decoding, and that derives the clock for the data interleaver decoding. So there you go. So it really starts with the pilot, and then from the pilot on the I channel, because there is no information on the Q channel, the data starts to come out on the I channel. You then use the sync words that are built into the packet to continue synchronization.
You think this is going to catch on? That's a joke. For those who are listening, this is TechNet number 1216 of the series that began in September of 1982. Eric, KE2EJ, the chief engineer of Channel 21 and Channel 13, is giving us a little bit more of a rundown of how digital television works. He's heavily involved in setting up now a couple of transmitters, I guess a total of three. At least one on World Trade, which had to be replaced to Empire, and at least one in Plainview. What's the total number of digital television transmitter setups that you have established so far, Eric? Go ahead.
Yeah, not counting, just counting for work, there's three, but not counting work, there's a few more. So I've helped, I helped a few people in California and in Tennessee and a few other places, and it's fun. It's interesting to see how it works, and it's also, I haven't yet written my letter to the gentleman at CBS. I think I'm going to do that this week and see if I can get his opinion as far as like what's going on with New York, which is a lot different than a lot of other places. K2RWK, Jack.
I see. That should be interesting. So I guess they've hired you as a consultant for a few other places since you have set up some of these and reasonably successfully and understand how to do it. I presume very few of these, even for the PBS system, are a turnkey operation.